Do the mountains and the blue Bavarian twilight cause the drum march to rattle into existence? Is the music an emanation of the mountains? Or are the peaks and valleys hauled into view by the march of drums? Are these Heideggerian questions, or is it just that the Teutonic opening credits, as red as the background of a Nazi flag, could not be any redder against the mountainous blue of snow-clad mountains and the deep blue sky passing for night? The wind is blowing through the mountain peaks, howling in that snowy, alpiney way, and the drums are more strident, more martial, and there are possibly even more of them than there were a few moments earlier, marching in formation, flying. We were over Germany and a blacker, less inviting piece of land I never saw, writes Martha Gellhorn in The Face of War. It was covered with snow. There was no light and no sign of human life, but the land itself looked actively hostile. We feel the same, even if the hostile land is not black. But if it was covered with snow, then it probably wouldn't have been black when she soared over it in 1945. So the point that needs to be made is that active hostility can look rather scenic, too. An aerial view from a plane becomes a scenic view of the plane, flying in lone formation, seen and heard, propelled by full Bruckneerian orchestra now, with a howling tailwind and drums marching so powerfully they could invade the soundtrack of a neighbouring cinema. Then it's a view from the plane again, peak surfing over the snow-scored mountains, tilting and gliding through the mountain passes, affording Panavision views of... Where are we, exactly? Font-wise, as the credits continue to roll, there's a hint of Castle Dracula and Transylvania, of Christopher Lee and Hammer Horror. But the plane is a German plane, a Junkers Ju-52, and it's giving a very persuasive demonstration of not only its manoeuvrability, but also the excellence of its camouflage, as it blends in with the snow-bound night. If a portion of the mountains had sprung to life, broken off, and assumed aerodynamic form, it would look exactly like the plane that is flying over them, as they stretch out like an enormously dormant snow leopard. The cockpit is greenishly lit. The pilot is wearing heavy gloves. It's cold inside as well as out. And the seven passengers sitting in a row in their snowsuits, Clint Eastwood at one end, Richard Burton at the other, are all looking anxious. Eastwood's way of looking anxious is to look relaxed, confident that the chaps in the middle are looking more anxious than him, which they are, of course. How could they not, relatively speaking, diminished as they must be, by the simple fact that they are not Eastwood or Burton, while being sandwiched between them? Burton is looking anxious because he has money worries of the kind that people who aren't weighed down by vast quantities of cash cannot begin to understand. Because he has enough dough to burn an elephant, more money than you could ever know what to do with, he has got into the habit of buying so much stuff that he might not have enough money to buy even more stuff. That's one of the motives for doing a picture like this, which will bring in fabulous amounts of money, so that he can buy his modern-day Cleopatra. Money for old rope, was her verdict on this caper. Things like a jet with burnished gold thrones instead of seats. Or it could just be that he's nursing a killer hangover, symbolically suggested by the way that, stacked up near him, are what appear to be metal beer barrels, so that as they approach the drop zone he looks at the blinking red light pulsing like a headache, like a warning of imminent liver failure, and we are suddenly back in the pre-mission briefing room where another red light is flashing. A nice touch by director Brian G. Hutton, as Patrick Wymark, Colonel Turner, gives the briefing as though it's been scripted not by Alistair MacLean but by William Shakespeare. Pre-mission briefings are always addressed to the audience, as well as the actors gathered around to listen, sitting or standing, Eastwood at the back, half in shadow, a shadowy presence, who are effectively our surrogates, eager to know what we and they are in for. Wymark points with his stick to the map on the wall, to the Schloss Adler, the Castle of the Eagles. Well named, he says, because only an eagle can get in there. He's right, it... The film is well named in the way that book or movie titles beginning with Where, Angels Fear to Tread, The Green Ant's Dream, Men Win Glory, or When, Eight Bells Toll, Worlds Collide, or for whom the bell tolls always are. Where Eagles Dare anticipates the widespread popularity of the SAS motto, Who Dares Wins, even though it was made a dozen years before the storming of the Iranian embassy, 1980, of which the film could be seen either as a prophetic allegory or a direct inspiration.